Hello, Alyssa Freeman.
Welcome to
Jeremy Chats with Coaches.
Now,
thank you very much.
Full disclosure. Thanks for being my second guest. Full disclosure to the audience: Alyssa has been my coach It's been a number of years since it's been official, but I think I'll call you my coach forever.
Nice, I love it.
So I know you a bit, but I think I'm going to get to know a lot more about you in the next hour. So tell me, Alyssa, who are you and what drew you to coaching?
Who am I? Well, my name's Alyssa Freeman, and that's what I do. That's my passion and my greatest gift, I believe. What was the other part of the question?
And how,
sorry, Jeremy?
Yeah, that's it. So the second part of the question is, yeah, what drew you to coaching in the first place? Tell me the story about how you ended up becoming a coach.
Mainly because of my own upbringing, I believe. So I had a very dysfunctional upbringing, and it caused a lot of trauma in my life, and a lot of it caused my relationships to fail. It caused me to act out in ways. I had some addictions to prescription drugs for a while. It had me having some eating problems as well, and I trace it all back to some serious dysfunction in my family upbringing. And I think that also too, I had a mother who was very, very depressed, so significantly depressed. So my mother was suicidal a lot of the time. So my childhood memories are often of not knowing if my mother would be alive or dead when I got home from school. Mm. And I know this sounds pretty dark.
Wow. Yeah.
And that's enough to kind of really crush a person. Mm. And I think that what it did is that because of my love of my mother, it really made me think about how I can help other people that
right.
are in that situation or have had similar upbringings. So when people tell me they're in a very dark place, I'm not afraid to go there with them because it's actually very familiar. And I understand it from that, from the perspective of being right there in the family with this experience.
Mm.
So I think people can open up and be very truthful with me because there's no judgment and I'm able to sit with that comfortably. Because I think that one, you know, often when people will say I'm in a really dark place to their friends or something, or even perhaps some counsellors who aren't very experienced with that, it can be a bit of a leap for them, or even for friends, yeah, it can be a very difficult conversation to have. They say, cheer up, let's change the subject.
Yeah.
You know, don't think about
yeah.
that. Whereas I'm happy to just, actually go, okay.
All you have to do is choose to be happy.
Yes, I'll say things like that.
Yeah.
Make a choice. So I think that what that made me is that to be a compassionate listener. I hope I am. And
you certainly are.
Of those experiences. Thank you. So those experiences I've been able to turn and help other people. So it doesn't matter what they tell me, because of the upbringing I have, there's nothing much new to me. So I can sit in that place. And then when a person feels that they're being heard, they're more likely to not only open up, but also have some healing. So when I might suggest something to a client, they're more likely to perhaps take that on board because of my experiences.
Yeah.
Myself and the fact that there's no judgment.
So then how did you even find out about the career of coaching?
It was actually by accident. So I was in a seminar room with my daughter. She was 12 years old, and someone said, oh, you know, come along to this seminar. And in this seminar, it was run by Christopher Howard was his name.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting there and he was talking actually about hypnotherapy because he is a hypnotherapist,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
as one of his modalities that he uses, and he's very, very good. my daughter at that time had an illness, and that was diagnosed as a anaphylactic response to getting her skin cold. And it meant, you know, as a 12-year-old, it was very difficult for her to go swimming. She wasn't able to go swimming. She wasn't able to do a lot of things, and she had to have me trailing around behind her a lot. So we're sitting in the seminar room, and the speaker talked about how hypnotherapy can help allergies. And it was just one moment when my daughter just looked at me and she just said, "Oh, Mum." And that was it for me. Now, I could have taken her to see a hypnotherapist, but that's not how I roll. I just went right and diving right in. If this can help my daughter, it can help me, it can help other people, it can help everyone in my family, my friends. So I ended up becoming qualified as a clinical hypnotherapist. That was the very beginning. And I weave a lot of that into my work.
I've noticed. And it's quite useful. So what would you say, and I know this is, so you're just rediscovering this at the moment, but or bringing out more of yourself in your coaching, but what would you say is the core philosophy behind your coaching, and how does that translate into tangible results for your clients?
So I'll start, I believe,
I'll break that down to, I'll first just say, what's the core philosophy behind your coaching?
The philosophy is that I believe that everyone has the ability to heal. That's it.
Excellent. And how does that translate into tangible results for your clients?
So the results for the clients depends on what results they want. It's not necessarily the results I want for them. So this is about the client. So when the client comes to me, they will very initially is that I want to know what their big goals are, the real big ones, the big ones that they haven't been able to get yet, or they need some support in getting. And then I'm able then to go, okay, we can work on this. And as long as it's ethical, so some, you know, if someone came to me with a goal that wasn't, then I didn't sit well with me, then, you know, I'm not the right coach. So you
wouldn't work with, coach someone on how to successfully murder their ex-partner without getting caught.
Exactly. I hope no one would.
That's okay. So, I'll find a different coach for that.
So I guess I've got to believe in their goal too.
Yeah.
And know that they, you know, for me, it's about making the world a better place. And with these clients that I attract into my life and who are attracted to me, vice versa, they're people who want to make the world a better place.
Mm.
And they can do that by all sorts of things. So that might be by becoming a speaker. It might be becoming a coach themselves. It might be by having a successful business. It might be by making lots of money. And because of the wonderful things that they're able to do with that. So it depends on the goal. So tangible results, I love this because what I love to see is them grow. And I had a 23-year-old client who was living at home with his parents. He didn't like living at home with his parents, but he was, and he knew he was a bit stuck. He had a lot of trouble with learning, so he'd failed school and he was working as a tradie, a basic tradie with pretty much no skill. But his big goal was to not only move out of home, but to actually own that home. And he was 23, and that's a big call.
Yeah, to be especially these days.
And owning your own home, especially on a really low wage that he was on.
Yeah.
And in the time that I coached him, before the end of the year, he owned his own home.
Before the end of the year?
Before the end of the year. And he also got qualifications. He stayed in the same job, but he got qualifications. So I coached him through learning, being able to learn and absorb information. I have a learning disability myself, so I was able to help with that a lot. So he got some qualifications, so his pay went right up. And then the last time I spoke to him, he's looking forward to getting his next home.
And how old is he now?
He'd be about 26 by now.
Nice. Very good. Well, I'll tell you some tangible results that you've got me. One of the things that you've taught me is how to face rejection, and you did some things with me that were practicing and even trying to get rejected to practice working through those feelings and whatever. And I have learned to always ask for what I want as far as customer service, especially with last week. I'm in hospital right now and I forgot to cancel my, I get HelloFresh meals, and I got a text saying that my credit card didn't get charged properly, but I still had a delivery coming the next day. So I called them straight away and said, please don't send that delivery. And they said, oh, we're able to cancel the delivery, but we already boxed it up, so you're still gonna have to pay for it. And so anyway, I ended up making another call and saying, I don't want to pay for it because I'm not even getting it. And pretty much every time I ask for these things now, the biggest was I asked a credit card to settle for less, and I think they settled for about half of what I owed them, which was actually way more than I was expecting when I went for it. But yeah, so that's tangible results you've definitely got me, is the ability to ask for things and get past the fear of rejection.
Fear of rejection is a huge one because it comes from a very ancient part of our brain. And I think I've told you this before too. So basically back in when we were cave people, you know, way back, where we're here we are in a cave and we're sitting around our little fire and it's wild beasts outside, there's ice and snow. And in that situation, if we're rejected, it's life-threatening. So if we were rejected, ask for something too much or do something, stand out, speak up, that can cause the tribe to say, out you go. We don't want you here anymore. Now, if you are rejected and out you go, you know, something's going to eat you or you're going to die of cold very, very quickly. So in our brain, what was hardwired is this thing that if we're rejected, we could die. And we don't necessarily think that when we're going to get rejected because it's quite deep. But that is where it comes from. So this is why we don't always want to ask for what we really want or speak up. This is why public speaking is an enormous fear for people. Oh, if they're noticed, they might get rejected. And then that little part of their brain thinks, oh no, we could die. So it does everything it possibly can to fit in, not speak up, tolerate things, and just settle.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that doesn't help us to grow. It doesn't help us to get our goals and to develop and to have boundaries. There's loads of things that will come from this.
Yeah.
So
it's funny because I have my friend who actually introduced me to you, I think you coached him something like 10 years ago or a long time ago. And I think you did this rejection exercise with him. And he, every time I go out with him, he's always asking for free stuff and at the restaurants that you're going to make this meal. And it's really kind of a joke. He expects them to say no, but it just doesn't scare him to ask for stuff, which is funny because as long as I've known him, he's been this gregarious character. But apparently he used to be shy and in his shell and completely different kind of person. I can't imagine him that way, but I think a lot of that had to do with your coaching.
Yes, so he says. So it was wonderful to coach him through that as well and to see his whole...
Did you know him as a shy... Did you know him as a shy in his shop? I can't imagine that.
Yeah, he came to
me. Imagine that.
Yeah, he was meek, if you like. And it wasn't truly who he was. It was a mask, if you like.
Yeah.
A mask that was, if I'm just like this, I'll be accepted and everything will be okay and I won't get rejected. And that little part of the brain says, you won't die if this happens. And so once he realized that it didn't kill him, he went all out, which was great.
Yeah, as a matter of fact,
so now he asks for whatever he wants.
He does. And not only that, we're both, I know him from improv theater. And, you know, most people that do improv theater do it on the stage, but everywhere we go, he's just calling in waitresses and everybody, other guests in the cafe, and just getting everyone to join together and playing some sort of scene. He just doesn't care what people think at all anymore. So no. I've only known him that way. There, it's so crazy to know he was acted as a different person before. But we'll come back to you and your coaching, although that does have to do with your coaching. But what? Let's see. Where were we? What I know sometimes with people like us who can coach other people to move forward in their own lives, often we're not as good at taking our own advice. What's something that comes from your coaching and coaching of other people that you have implemented in your own life that's made a big difference in your own life?
Okay. Well, there's two parts that I'd like to answer about this. The first one is that I get asked this actually by people who are looking for a coach, and I say, mm-hmm. you know, what do I look for? What do I look for in a coach? And I say that one of the most important things is that you ask that your coach, who coaches them, or are they coached? Yeah. And I think that that's really important, because it's a bit like going to a dentist, and the dentist never goes to a dentist.
Mm-hmm.
You would go, well, what's going on here? There's something that's not quite right. So if there's someone who's coaching others who doesn't have their own coach, which means isn't getting an outside perspective of their journey and their blind spots, why? That's a red flag for me. So I believe that coaches also need coaches. And I coach a lot of coaches because of that. And I have coaches. And I think that that's one of the really important things, is that if the person says, oh, no, I don't need a coach, here you are, you're asking your coach, do you have a coach? Oh, no, I don't need it. I've got all the information. I'm there. I've made it. I'm there yet. You know, I'm completely there now. And it's not true.
No, because we have they'd be in nirvana. They wouldn't still be here on this earth.
That's right. Oh, yeah, I had someone ask me once, what's it like, Alyssa, to have all your shit together?
Yeah. I don't know. I'd like to know.
I'm so hard at it. And I said, I don't have all my shit together. I'm a work in progress too. And as long as I'm still working on myself and I have the skills and tools to help you work on yourself, we're in a good place. Now, the other part of it is you asked me about my own using the tools.
What's something in your own life? Yeah.
Yeah. So I work on stuff all the time. It's changed over the years, because in the very beginning, I was dealing with a lot of my old trauma from childhood. And I worked a lot on that. Now, after I cleared all that really big stuff away, it always leaves a scar, but not a wound. The wound is healed. The scar is left, but the scar is something that I wear with pride. And a scar's healed, right? A scar's healed, but it changes you a little. The scars is an analogy of just that way that it changes us a little bit.
Yeah.
So I use the tools that I work with other people and get them to do things. I do it too. So I would never ask a client to do something, like ask for what they want, if I don't do that too. So I don't ask them to do things that I would never do. So I use the tools all the time, because we're a work in progress. I find that there's often things, something will trigger a memory and I go, oh, that's something I need to work on. Or, gee, I'm struggling with this thing. Okay, there's something there. Now, because I have the tools, I can use those. And I'll put together a writing process for myself, or a meditation for myself, a hypnosis for myself, and I can use those to help me. And they're also using someone else's perspective and a coach, because sometimes I got a blind spot. We all do. We all have blind spots about ourselves. One of the hardest things for us to do is to actually see ourselves completely. Very difficult. So sometimes when you've got that outside perspective, of someone saying, okay, you know, maybe what you're seeing, you know, this person might think that they're always wrong about something. Well, you know, maybe they're not. Yeah. Maybe they've just blocked out those times that they're actually right. Or the person that doesn't believe that they're beautiful. And they might need another perspective of someone, because no matter how hard they look, they go, well, I'm not beautiful, and that's it.
Yeah.
I might just have to accept that I'm not beautiful. But when you've got someone else that can see that perspective and see their beauty, they can point it out to them. And if they're open enough and receptive enough, they might just start to see it too, changing that person's whole perspective about themselves.
So back to you, so, what would you say is the number one change that you've made in your life over the course of your time as a coach?
Oh, okay. So it would be financially. So part of my upbringing, I was brought up very, very poor. So we lived in a tiny little, it was six of us, and we lived in a tiny little two-bedroom house. It was a fibro house. And my father had a illness and was never able to work. He worked as a much younger man a little bit, but once he was properly diagnosed, and he went on a pension pretty much. So my mother was a nurse before she married him, and she became pretty much his carer.
Right.
So my parents were always at home, and they didn't have any paid work at all. It was all welfare. So basically I was brought up entirely on welfare, and there wasn't much of anything. So my mother was very handy. She made our clothes because we couldn't buy clothes. She had a big veggie garden. Luckily, she had a garden to do that in. And we lived near the water. So she would fish and garden, and we would have fish and vegetables or fruit. Mm. So we were able to eat that way. There was very, very much not much of anything. So it was, I call it dirt poor. That's the way I was brought up. And because of that, I had absorbed a lot of money and wealth beliefs that weren't true and were quite destructive to me. So I pretty much thought that that was my lot. I would be poor till the day I died. And you wouldn't want to be rich anyway, because rich people were evil, con men or con people, and cold, hard, not good for the earth, not good for the planet, and were out to get everything they could. These were the beliefs that were embedded in me as a child, and it stuck for a really long time. So once I left home, it was a struggle, financial struggle all the time. There was a long, hard pattern of financial struggle that was very, very difficult for me to see any other perspective other than struggle. So, you know, I can remember times in my 20s where I had to go to welfare to get food. And there was times where, you know, I was sleeping on people's couches. It was, but I saw that as just that's just what you do. And the people who had money, they did that by being bad people. Mm. That was the belief, the unconscious belief that was running things for me. And that was probably the biggest change that was made. Once I start to look at beliefs in myself and I started to work through those and the old things that perhaps my parents said to me as a child that really got into my head and started to affect my behavior. And even if money came to me, it would somehow disappear very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, I might get a job, but it would always be gone before the end of the week, and I'd be struggling to eat before the next, you know, pay check would come in. So when I started working on these beliefs, and I started to untangle this mess of beliefs around finances, and started to do some rewiring in my brain. So not just removing the old ones, but putting new beliefs in. Beliefs about all sorts of things, but in this example, it's about wealth and money. Now, money is just energy. It's like anything in the universe. It's all energy. But I didn't see it like that, and I started to realize that this is what it was. And then I realized that I could choose money to have any energy it wanted to. So I could actually say money was love. And if money was love, how would I use it? What would I do with it? And things started to happen. Money started to flow in. And I remember once I was speaking at, I had a speaking job training the staff at the University of Queensland. And they got me in there and they were paying, now this is back probably about over 10 years, about 15 years ago now. And they got me in there, and at that time they were paying the going rate for a day training the staff, which was about $2,000 a day. Back then that was, you know, quite a lot, but it was the standard. And at one point I was having a conversation with my mother, and she said, oh, how are you going? And I said, oh, yeah, it's really good. I got this break and I'm training the staff at UQ. And she said, oh, that's good, love. And do you get paid? And I said, yeah, I'm getting paid quite well for it. It was probably the most I'd ever been paid for a day's work ever. And she said, oh, how much did you get paid? And I said, oh, it was $2,000 a day. And she said, oh, that's so much. You got a whole $200 a day. I said, no, Mum, $2,000 a day. Yes, love, yes, oh, $200 a day. She couldn't even hear that amount because it was so outside of her experience. I let it go. Yeah. I just went, yeah, Mum, okay. And that was a huge realization for me because I thought, oh, you know, there's such a block there. She couldn't even hear that amount of money for a day's work. And it was the most I'd ever earned too. It was awesome.
Yeah.
So from there, now I like to help other people with wealth creation because I think it's a big block for a lot of people. So it's one of the areas that I like to specialize in because of my own experience with it. And knowing that the really cool things you can do with money that really does make a difference. Helping other people, helping the world. It's very difficult to do that with no money.
Yes.
So that's probably one of the biggest shifts. One of the biggest.
It is.
Many.
it is difficult to do that without money because even if what you want to, if you're like, well, instead of giving money, I'll give time, but you need that time to make the money to be able to have food and shelter. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's much easier to help people when you have a bit of money. Would you like to share a little bit about your... You've told me, I don't know if you're going public with it yet, but you're the shamanic stuff that you're looking towards doing now?
Yeah. So most of my life...
I just asked because whenever we talked about it, it's lit you up and I'd like to hear that light.
Yes. First of all, I use the word just, I don't associate it with any particular culture. Mm-hmm. And when I've searched what I do and my beliefs, it's the closest thing that fits to what I do or believe in. Mm-hmm. And so that's the word that I use because there's not necessarily anything else that fits that. So not associated with any particular culture, but pretty much most of my life I've studied mythology and studied the shamanic practices from people from all over the world.
So define shamanic practices from your perspective, the way that you're using it.
The way that I use it is that it's a very spiritual practice. So it's more inward. I use meditation a lot. So this is a journeying type of meditation. So not just breath work or anything like that, which I love and use. But tapping into intuition. I also use symbols. So I utilize symbols a lot in dreams. I do a lot of dream analysis work with clients as well. And waking dreaming, which is the things that we might notice or see. We actually talked a little bit about this a little while ago. You might see, you might be walking down the street and there's a crack in the pavement. And for some reason you notice it. And other days you don't. Mm. Or there's a feather that's just fluttering there where you're walking. For some reason you notice it. Or a particular sound that's made. Doesn't necessarily have to be what you see. It could be just a sound that you hear. And for some reason you notice that sound. And there can be little messages in those things. A little reminder. And what they are is completely unique. You can't say, a feather means this. Or a crack in the pavement means that. It's so personal. And it also depends on what you're working on at that time, what challenge you have at that time. You know, you might see the crack in the pavement and you have a challenge, and all of a sudden it means to you that you need to go and live overseas. But for another person, it could mean that you need to go and have that conversation with your neighbor.
So I gather you're not using like a dream interpretation book or something. You're drawing out of the person their own meaning from it.
My advice to anyone who has a dream analysis book is to put it in the bin. And I know that sounds brutal because there's so many. We're all so different. So basically.
Yeah, that's my advice to anyone who has a parenting book, like for after when your kids are born as well, because that parenting book is a fantastic manual for how to raise that author's children in the environment that author raised their children. And that's it.
Exactly. Exactly. I know. Throw those ones away too. So with the dreams, it's affected by your beliefs, your personality, your upbringing, and most importantly, it's affected by your culture. And culture has the deepest roots in us. We carry about 7 generations of memories in our cells, and this has now been proven by science. Your cultural background has a huge impact on your dreaming, whether it's the waking dreaming or sleep dreaming, and that symbols and what they mean to you. Could be complete opposites. You know, to the English person dreaming of a dragon could be very different to a Chinese person dreaming of a dragon because of the cultural background there. And so when you're doing dream analysis, it's very much about what that person's deep symbolism is reflected in that symbol.
Yeah.
And finding that out.
It reminds me of the Rorschach test where everyone will see something different and then it's all about drawing out why they see what they see.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And there is a method to it, and I teach my clients this, and then they can analyze their own meaning. Or what did that, you know, why did I open the fridge and I suddenly saw the rotten old cabbage there when I hadn't seen it for a week?
Yeah.
Well, that rotten old cabbage there is, you know, the reason you noticed it is that the unconscious mind is filtering constantly. It's also trying to help us. So it might say, okay, this symbolizes it, rotten old cabbage in the fridge is symbolizing this particular thing, and I want my person to be aware of this. So it'll draw the awareness to those things. Because we only see a fraction of what's actually coming in to our awareness. We can't see it all. We can't smell it all. We can't taste or feel it or hear it all because it would just be too much for our brains to compute. So it's all filtered out. So these little things that filter, that come in through the filters, we need to take notice of them and then be able to analyze them using our own system. And then know what step forward we need to take. You know, so we see the crack in the pavement, and then that might mean to someone to talk to their neighbour. They don't know why they need to talk to their neighbour. But the next step is actually doing it.
Yeah.
It might be good to go, oh, I've got a symbol to go and do this. Oh, that's nice. And forget about it. That's not why it's there. It's there to say, yeah, go talk to the neighbour. You need to talk to the neighbour and you need to do it now. And it might feel weird. Here you are going along, knocking on the door. I don't know why I'm here. I just wanted to say hi. But it will be revealed. So that's
leads. Yeah, go ahead.
So that's the really important part, is the action step. Taking action on what these things are. And you'll be through, you know, you just said before you're in hospital, and these little, you know, these little messages would have been coming to you.
Yep.
These little messages would have been coming to you.
This message said, start this podcast that you've been saying you're going to start for years.
And what happened?
I started it.
Yeah, you started it. Exactly. Thank you for being in hospital to do that.
I think it, well, actually, yes, it did. So how do you maintain a balance between pushing your clients to their limits and ensuring that they don't burn out?
Okay, limits are a really interesting point, actually, because there is, we've all heard of a comfort zone, right? We all know what a comfort zone is. It's a space that we feel really comfortable in. It doesn't push our boundaries at all. There was a study done across two universities. It was Harvard and another business school in America, where they were looking into, now getting to this point, so we're going to background first, is that they wanted to find out about people's saving money, why some people could save, why some people couldn't, what was the perfect saving amount. So they got these students and they got them all to save certain different percentages of their income, 1% right up to 50%. And they studied, did it last? Did they keep saving? Did it fall off? When did it fall off? And they found an interesting thing. They found that right up to 10% of saving money, those people were able to keep saving and didn't change their lifestyle at all, didn't change really anything they were doing, but they were able to put up to 10% of their income into savings regularly, and it could keep going. They didn't even notice. It could be automatically taken out and nothing changed. Once it hit over 10%, then things suddenly changed. Suddenly, people would do things like save a bit and then use it, not save, then go back to saving, then spend it all. It was all over the place. Right up to when those people were trying to save like 50%, it was not only were they unable to maintain that, but it actually put them into a worse financial situation. They'd blow it all, feel bad about themselves, spend more money to feel better, and end up being more in debt. So it actually had the reverse effect. Now, the studies was a big deal because psychologists got hold of it and said, okay, let's have a look at the psychology behind that. And does it work with anything else other than money?
Mm.
And the short answer is yes. It works across the board with everything. And these people that are like, go hard, go hard, go hard, push, 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 it cannot be maintained. Not only can it not be maintained, but most people will shrink back further because they get burnt. So what's really important with growth is that it's done in a way that is ethical for the person as a whole. So I make sure that my clients don't take those massive leaps. If they want those massive leaps, I explain to them why that's not going to be a good thing. When you want your goal, it's little step by little step by little step, no more than 10% outside of your comfort zone.
Gotcha.
So each step needs to be within the 10%. And before you know it, you've taken 50%, you've taken 100%, but in little 10% increments. Because what happens is that your comfort zone stretches. It stretches and shrinks depending on what's going on, right? So if you're massively taking these massive steps way too far outside your comfort zone, when that rubber band stretches and stretches and stretches and it springs back, the comfort zone can shrink. So that person can go, well, my God, I'm not going anywhere near that anymore. My life has become smaller. So then when you take a 10% increment and you're behaving in a within 10%, so you're doing something that's just outside your comfort zone, just a little bit, what happens is the comfort zone goes, well, that doesn't hurt, that's fine, that's okay, and your comfort zone stretches to include that 10%, which means the next time you take another step forward doing something that's 10% out, it's almost 20% more than the original, but it only feels like 10%. So you keep growing, doing more and more outside of your comfort zone with these little 10% increments. This is how to stop burnout and a spring back. So it's really important, and often I will make my clients tell me what that number is. What's that number?
Mm-hmm. I remember.
Outside your comfort zone. And if they go, it's 15, I say, okay, we've got to bring it down. What's the first step there? Can we halve that number? Because the problem with is if something's over 10%, you're less likely to do it.
Yep.
Consistently. And that's what we want, consistency to grow. So that it's not just one win, but you're having a lifetime of wins.
Yeah.
And that you keep growing. So that's what's really important here with the growth, the whole growth thing. Yeah. Does that make sense?
It does. Now, we're just about out of time. I'm hoping that you will come on as a guest again in the near future and we can continue and have a longer conversation. But for now, to cap off this conversation, is there anything that we started talking about that you didn't get to say as much as you wanted to because we headed off in a different direction?
No, that was great. I've really been very happy to be on the show, and I'd love to come back. That'd be great.
And is there anything about you, your philosophy, and your work that I didn't, even though I've known you for a little while, you've known yourself for a lot longer, and you know your work a lot better than I do, is there anything that didn't even come up that would be a glaring omission in a discussion of Alyssa as Alyssa Freeman as a person and as a coach?
Well, I really believe that coaching is really important. So if you have any listeners out there and I have an urge to contact a coach or just ask a question, do it, because it cannot hurt you. It's all good. If you get the right match, then, you know, it can be many, many years of a very fruitful relationship.
Yeah, and I would add to that if it's not the right match, don't think that coaching doesn't work or counseling or psychology, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. If it's not the right match, then find the right match. Don't give up.
Yeah.
So how can listeners find you, Alyssa? Alyssa, so how can listeners find you?
So, yes, I have a website if they want to find me. It's alyssafreeman.com.au, and there's contact details there and a few little videos and such if they want to check it out.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Alyssa, and we'll see you again on an episode very soon.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. It's great to chat, and I hope everyone got something out of that.
Well, I know I certainly did, if nobody else did, but I'm pretty sure everybody else will have as well. Thanks, Alyssa. Bye.
Welcome.